Tonight we're going to move on to the external evidence for the Christian God. We're going to look at two separate lines of evidence, one of which is the origin of the universe. The other is the organization of the universe. Or to put that in philosophical terms, we're going to be looking at the argument from cosmology, cosmological argument. And then secondly, we're going to be looking at the teleological argument, which we're going to explain as we go. Well, let's get started with that first argument, the origin of the universe. The ancient Jews were a strange group of people. I don't know if you've ever studied comparative religions very much or read the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament. But the ancient Jews were strange. Perhaps strange wouldn't be the best term. Maybe unique would be better. Let's compare the Hebrews with the other nations. The Hebrews were monotheistic. Mono meaning one, theos meaning God, ism meaning worldview. They believed in one infinite personal God. The surrounding nations were polytheistic. Poly meaning many, theos meaning God, ism meaning a worldview. They believed in many gods. The ancient Jews believed that God brought into being the universe. The surrounding ancient Near Eastern creation myths don't really focus on the origination of the universe. Instead, they focus upon the origination of the gods themselves, how the gods came into being. The ancient Jews believed that humans were central to God's plan in the cosmos. Human beings were the divine creation of God. They were his image bearers. They were supposed to have dominion and rule over the planet Earth, to treat it respectfully. Whereas the other nations believed that humans were merely an afterthought. The focus of the other ancient Near Eastern creation myths is not on humans, but on the gods themselves. Of course, the Hebrews believed in an ex nihilo creation. Ex is the Latin preposition meaning from or out of. Nihilo or nihil meaning nothing. Ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. Whereas the surrounding Babylonian and Sumerian and other myths believed that the gods created out of pre-existing matter. They created out of pre-existing matter. The Hebrews believed that the celestial furniture, the sun, the moon, the stars, what were these? Well, to a Hebrew, they believed that these were just the furniture of the universe. God created them. They weren't gods. They weren't personal agents. They were just part of the cause and effect of the universe that Yahweh had created. Read Genesis 1 for that. Whereas the other nations believed that the sun, the moon, and the stars were gods themselves. They worshipped these inanimate objects or moving on the same structural pattern in the cosmos. If you want to do yourself a favor, pick up G. Ernest Wright's book, this book, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, an absolute tour de force regarding the notion that monotheism emerged slowly from spiritism to polytheism to henotheism, finally to monotheism. Ancient man worshipped spirits, and then they worshipped gods, and then they worshipped a god above all the gods, and then finally they ended up worshipping one infinite personal god, monotheism. G. Ernest Wright, a Harvard scholar, also an archaeologist, completely puts the smack down on that theory of religious Darwinism in this book. This is what he writes on page 28. He says, "It is impossible to see how this God of Israel could have evolved slowly from polytheism. The two faiths rest on entirely different foundations. The religion of Israel suddenly appears in history." Now, as you read G. Ernest Wright's book, one of the things you notice is that he's actually a critical scholar of the Bible. And yet, he makes that statement that monotheism actually emerges out of nothing. In the ancient Near East, the other worldviews didn't hold the same beliefs that the Hebrews held. Alexander Heidel, he's an Assyriologist from the University of Chicago. He wrote a book called The Babylonian Genesis, where he compares the Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian creation myth, with the book of Genesis and the Hebrew account of creation. On page 96, he writes this: "The earliest stages of creation are thus ascribed to sexual congress." What a very polite way of describing that the gods had sex with each other, or sometimes they had war with each other, or sometimes they had warlike sex with each other. And out of that sprung the origination of the universe, according to the Enuma Elish. He writes, "Then after war had broken out among the gods, Ea killed Apsu, and with his carcass he formed the subterranean sea on which the earth rests. So the gods killed one another, and out of their divine being sprung the universe, the planets, the stars." Heidel writes, "Apsu and Tiamat, two gods, were not simply the ancestors of the gods. They represented at the same time the living, uncreated world matter, that the gods themselves were incorporated into matter. They were matter and divine spirit united and coexistent like body and soul. In sharp contrast to this, the book of Genesis speaks of only one divine principle existing apart from and independently of all cosmic matter. Fundamentally, two different accounts of creation, that the gods were one and the same with creation, and that there was an infinite personal God who was separate from creation but brought creation into being out of nothing." Heidel writes on page 89, "It is apparent that for the Babylonians, matter was eternal. They didn't believe that matter popped into being. They believed that matter existed eternally into the past." On page 126, Heidel notes, "The word of the Babylonian deities was not almighty. They didn't have the chutzpah to bring the universe into being. They were weak. They were polytheistic deities who they didn't believe could create the universe out of nothing." Christian astrophysicist Hugh Ross: "No other quote-unquote holy book makes such a claim on its own. The concept appears elsewhere only in those books that borrow from the Bible, such as the Quran and the Mormon writings. The notion of a creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, that was something that was unique to the ancient Jews. No other holy book has that claim on its own." So the Jews were unique. What's interesting is the New Testament was birthed out of the Old Testament. Christians did not start a new religion. They believed that they were the fulfillment of a very old religion, which was Judaism. So when the New Testament authors, most of whom were Jewish, came on the scene in the first century and wrote their books, they also agreed with the Hebrew Bible that the universe came into being out of nothing, a creation ex nihilo. So John writes in John 1:3 that everything that has come into being came into being through the Word, which is Christ. Hebrews 11:3 states that everything which has been made out of things which are not seen, a creation out of nothing. Colossians 1:15, well, throughout the New Testament, we see this same scandalous view that the universe was birthed out of nothing by a divine act of God. Now, you have to think about it. They must have paid a cost to believe that the universe was not eternal in the past. The Greek Stoics didn't believe that. Stoicism argued that the universe has been here forever, that it didn't come into being out of nothing. So they held this view even in contrast to their culture. As Christianity expanded, the early Christian leaders also held this view. For example, Irenaeus, Clement of Rome, Polycarp, Justin Martyr, Athenagoras, Augustine, etc., 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 all down through the centuries. Even when everyone in the culture said, well, the universe has just always been here. Where did the universe come from? It's just there. That's the explanation. It's always been here. We came into existence, but not the universe. So all the way down through the centuries, we're talking about 3,000 plus years. Judeo-Christian thought argued that the universe was birthed in a single moment of divine creation. And everyone else thought that that was absolutely ridiculous. Well, this all changed in the 20th century with the advent of modern science and scientific discoveries. What we came to find out is that the ancient Jews had it right all along. And we're going to look at two major scientific discoveries that have led the consensus of modern science to believe that the universe began to exist at a finite point in the past. Well, let's get started with that first scientific discovery. Number one, the second law of thermodynamics. This law of physics states that the amount of usable energy will decrease in a closed system. Note what this is not saying. It's not saying that energy goes away. That's not what it's saying. Because the first law of thermodynamics would disagree with that. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. What it's saying is that usable energy reaches a state of entropy, where energy is no longer usable. It still exists, but it's not usable. So to put this in the form of an illustration, imagine if I came in here with a bottle of cologne. Okay? Or let's say a bottle of Axe spray. Flooding up the entire air in front of me, okay? Now, the people in the front row would eventually smell that. I would smell like a frat guy on campus, okay? Then the people halfway back, about 10 minutes later, they would begin to smell the cologne. Then the people in the far back room would eventually be able to smell the cologne as well. Now, would you ever expect that the cologne would just stink up this part of the room? Well, no. Eventually, all that cologne will spread out evenly throughout the entire room. It might take some time. It might not happen immediately. But that cologne will reach a state of entropy across the room. Same thing is true when you open up the valve on your bathtub. If you put a bunch of ice into the bathtub and you cranked that heat up on your hot water and you poured the hot water into one side of the tub, would you ever expect half of the water in the tub to be piping hot and the other half to be freezing cold? Well, maybe at first, maybe before the hot water, that usable energy moved into the entirety of the tub. But eventually, that hot water would reach a state of entropy, a state of evenness. Well, this is the second law of thermodynamics at work. This implies that eventually our universe will reach a state of heat death. When we look out at the cosmos itself is a closed system. It doesn't go on infinitely. The cosmos itself is a closed system. So when we look out at the universe, what we find are billions upon billions and trillions of stars out there. But these stars are on mid-burn. Some of them have snuffed out. Some of them have already hit a supernova and exploded. And eventually, all of the usable energy, while it's now in pockets of heat and light in these stars, eventually this will reach a state of entropy where these stars will burn out and their energy will be spread across the cosmos. But they haven't done this yet. Right now, we're in a state where we're near a star that's heating our planet. It hasn't burned out yet. Well, this reaches a startling conclusion when you think about it. If we're looking out at all the stars, and all of the stars are on a half a tank of gas, okay? They're on mid-burn. They're on their way to burning out. What does that imply? It implies that they were not burning forever. For if they were burning forever, they would have burned out an infinite time ago. But we're watching them on a half a tank of gas as we speak. To put that another way, if the stars in our universe will not burn forever in the future, well then, we know that they have not been burning forever in the past. What this means is that the second law of thermodynamics implies that we do not live in an eternal universe, but that the universe was infused with energy a finite time ago. Now, we don't know how long from this law, but we do know that at least it is finite. Agnostic physicist Paul Davies writes about this in this way. The universe is like a clock slowly winding down. how did it get wound up in the first place? Okay, so that's the first bit of scientific evidence for the beginning of our universe. But the second line of evidence is Big Bang cosmology. Big Bang cosmology. Now, every time I teach this, I always take a poll. And you have to vote. This is not the 2008 election. You have to vote. And if you vote, you can't lie either. You have to be honest, okay? Who here has heard of the oscillating universe cosmology? Okay, pretty good. Who here has heard of the eternal universe cosmology? Okay, or static universe, okay. Who here has heard of Hartle-Hawking cosmology? Okay, a few people, all right. Who here has heard of the Big Bang Theory? Okay, all the hands go up. There's a reason why you've all heard of the Big Bang cosmology. Here's the reason. Big Bang cosmology is the consensus in modern science and physics today. There's a reason why you were taught that in public school. It's because that's what the consensus, not all scientists, but the consensus, the majority of modern physics believes in Big Bang cosmology. Well, let's just do a quick history of the Big Bang. How was this discovered? Well, it begins with a really unknown scientist in 1917, Albert Einstein. Einstein came up with a theory called the general theory of relativity. When Einstein discovered this, it had tremendous implications for the cosmos. The theory of relativity implied that either the universe was in a state of expansion or it was in a state of contraction, but it couldn't be static. It couldn't stay the same. When Einstein discovered this, Einstein was a believer in God, but he believed in the pantheistic God, not a personal God. When he discovered this, it bothered him. The idea that the universe would be expanding or contracting, it really bugged him a lot. So he put in a fudge factor into the equation called a cosmological constant that he put into the material to make it so that the universe was static and not expanding or contracting. Well, this is the way John Barrow describes this blunder in Einstein's theory. Barrow writes, Einstein's static universe was a dead duck, and its inventor later regretted the introduction of the cosmological constant to sustain a static universe. He screwed up. He should have never done this. Barrow writes, Einstein called it the biggest blunder of my life because he missed the opportunity to make the greatest scientific prediction of all time, the expansion of the universe. So this bothered Einstein because he could have been the first one to discover the Big Bang, that our universe was expanding. Well, in the 1920s, there were two mathematicians, Alexander Friedman, he was a Russian, and Georges Lemaître, who was a Belgian. Friedman in Russia and Lemaître in Belgium, both independently looked at Einstein's theory and figured out that the universe was in a state of expansion. Lemaître was the first one to come up with this. He quickly got in touch with Friedman. He had the same exact prediction. They got together and figured out that the universe is expanding. Well, there's another man you've probably never heard of, Edwin Hubble. Anyone know what he was the inventor of? Hubble telescope. I'll take that murmuring to mean Hubble telescope. Edwin Hubble looked through a telescope with a 100-inch lens. He looked out at the cosmos, and when he looked at the different stars, what Hubble discovered is that there was a red shift to all the distant stars. Now, a blue shift on the Doppler effect would mean that the light waves are actually being compressed. That would mean that the stars are moving closer to you. A red shift, however, means that the light waves are actually being retracted. They're being stretched and expanded. I'm sure you've all stood by a, I don't know if you've ever had to fix a flat tire out on the highway. When a big semi comes by, you hear the sound. All the way down the highway. The sound of that semi didn't change. What happened was the Doppler effect. These sound waves are being compressed or retracted. Well, the same is true with light. Well, Hubble looked out at every star he could look at, and he saw that there was a redshift to these stars. Well, this is the way Roger Penrose describes it in his book, Road to Reality. He says Hubble found that this redshift was systematically greater the more distant the galaxy appeared to be. So the farther away it was, the greater the redshift, indicating a velocity of recession that is proportional to the distance from us, consistently with the explosion picture. So he figured out that the stars were exceedingly moving far away from the planet Earth. Well, then some time passed. 1965 and 1989, we had two more discoveries that helped confirm the Big Bang. John Barrow, another agnostic physicist from Oxford, he writes this. He says, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson were rejigging a receiver originally designed to rack the Echo communication satellite so as to use it for radio astronomy. So these guys were out there actually on a different mission. He writes, as they turned the receiver, they found that they picked up a persistent low-level source of microwave radiation or radio noise with the same intensity all around the sky. So when they put this receiver out into the sky, they found this kind of backwash of microwave radiation, which is what theorists predicted would happen after the Big Bang, that there would be kind of this residue. To give you an illustration, it would be like if you walked into a room and maybe you're babysitting some kids and you smell sulfur and smoke in the room. Now, if you came in, maybe you didn't see the kids playing with firecrackers, okay? But you came in and you saw the leftover, the residue in the room. Well, the same is true with the Big Bang. It was such a powerful explosion. It left this wash of microwave radiation. Well, that was in 1965. In 1989, NASA launched the COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer, satellite out into space, and they discovered the same thing. They came back with beautiful pictures of this radiation wash. Penrose writes this, the most impressive direct piece of observational support for the Big Bang is the universal presence of radiation permeating space, having the temperature of about 2.7 Kelvin, in essence 2.7 degrees centigrade above absolute zero. So you would expect the universe actually to be really close to absolute zero, very cold. It's actually warmer than you would expect because of this Big Bang event. Although this may seem to be an extraordinarily low temperature for such a violent event, this radiation is believed to be the flash of the Big Bang itself. So we can actually see the residue of this event. Okay, so far what we've looked at are two lines of scientific evidence for the origin of the universe, that it has not existed eternally in the past, but it had a beginning a finite time ago. Just to make this more clear, the discovery of the Big Bang is not Christian science. It's not creation science. It's not a religious theory. This theory could be found in any science textbook. Many of you were probably taught this theory in high school. And it's held by the consensus of modern physics and cosmology today. It's not as though Christians came up with this, okay? Secular physicists discovered this theory. Well, what I'd like to do right now is read from Paul Davies. He's not a believer in Christ. He's not even a believer in God. He's agnostic. He makes that very clear. I'm going to read quotes later that you'll see. He's not even a believer in God at all. This is from his book, Cosmic Jackpot. And I could explain what the Big Bang theory implies, but I would like to just read it straight from his pen right here. He writes, I shall start by ignoring inflation for a moment and adopting an obviously unsound model of the universe, a perfectly round ball of matter surrounded by an infinite void. We know that the universe is expanding, so the ball had better be getting bigger and bigger with time. In the past, it was smaller. If we run the expansion in reverse for 13.7 billion years, then the ball shrinks to a single point, a single sizeless dot. And then? Nothing. The ball has vanished. Play the sequence forward and the universe appears from nothing at a single point, balloons out and eventually expands to cosmic proportions. Now, let's consider what is meant by nothing in the foregoing description. Clearly, it is empty space. If this account captures the essential manner in which the universe came into existence, then we are left with a puzzle. Why should a ball of matter suddenly appear out of nowhere at some particular moment in time and at some particular location in pre-existing empty space, when this event hasn't happened for all eternity up to that moment? You see what he's saying? Why did this thing just pop into being out of nothing? Well, he writes, what would cause it to happen and happen just then and just there? There is no satisfactory answer. Well, again, let's play the movie in reverse. The surface of the ball shrinks into the center until all points of the surface converge at a single point of space. And then? Nothing. But in this case, nothing is not a surrounding void, because the only space that matters, physical space, is represented by the surface of the sphere, and that has totally vanished. So he's really trying to get at, what are we saying when we say that the universe came from nothing? What does nothing mean? Well, he writes, this time the nothing before the Big Bang really is no thing, neither matter nor space, nothing. Could he be any more clear? Nothing at all. It came into being out of nothing. Could the singularity not have just sat there? This is the way Richard Dawkins handles it in his book, The God Delusion. He says, well, the Big Bang was a singularity. That's where the universe came from, was a singularity. What he fails to realize is that a singularity is not an explanation of where the universe came from. It's a description of how the universe came into being. It doesn't explain anything at all. That's what Davy says right here. Could the singularity not have just sat there? In that case, what came before the Big Bang would no longer be nothing. It would be a singularity. Some popular accounts of the origin of the universe promulgate this dubious, that is, doubtful notion. However, it won't do. The theory of relativity links space and time together to form a unified space-time. You can't have space without time and time without space. So if space cannot be continued back through the Big Bang singularity, then neither can time. This conclusion carries a momentous implication. No kidding. Watch what he says here. If the universe was bounded by a past singularity, then the Big Bang was not just the origin of space. It was the origin of time, too. To repeat, time itself began at the Big Bang. If there was no time or place before the Big Bang for a causative agency to exist. Wait a minute, what's that mean? That's kind of philosophical language. Causative agency. A cause. If there was no time and space for a cause to exist, then we can attribute no physical cause to the Big Bang. Well, I guess as Christians, we would agree with that point, wouldn't we? If all time and space, matter and energy, came into being at the Big Bang, then there could be no physical cause responsible for it. But what about a non-physical? Maybe it's not a natural cause, perhaps a supernatural cause. Stephen Hawking writes this. This is in a series of lectures he gave with his colleague Roger Penrose. It's called The Nature of Space and Time. Hawking writes, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now, when you've got somebody of Stephen Hawking's prestige making a universal claim like that, just everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. You better believe that that is a pretty reliable statement. Fred Hoyle, this is the guy back in 1948, when the evidence was piling up for the Big Bang. Hoyle was an astronomer. He was an atheist. And as the evidence was piling up, Hoyle was getting really ticked about this theory. It bothered him quite a bit. So finally, one day, they were explaining this theory to him. It was his secular colleagues were explaining the Big Bang. And Hoyle said, wait a minute. What you're saying there is like the universe began with like a Big Bang. And his colleagues heard him say that phrase, Big Bang, and they were like, good expression. I think we'll keep it. So Hoyle was the one who actually coined the term Big Bang. Well, this is what he writes in Astronomy Today. He says, this most peculiar situation is taken by many astronomers to represent the origin of the universe. The universe is supposed to have begun at this particular time. From where? The usual answer, surely an unsatisfactory one, is from nothing. The universe began to exist from nothing. John Barrow of Oxford writes this. At this singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally, nothing existed before the singularity. So if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo, or out of nothing. The singularity is to be regarded as being on the boundary of space-time. Now, the reason why I put multiple different authors and expressing this theory in multiple different ways is to demonstrate this is not creation science. This is not Christians coming up with this. What we've got here are secular, prestigious cosmologists all claiming the same thing. What we've studied so far is not very controversial. There are some people who disagree with it. Not many. To put that another way, the facts of the Big Bang are generally agreed upon. The science, the facts are agreed upon. It's the interpretation of the facts that's hotly debated. This is where the debate lies, not in the science, not in creation science versus secular science. We agree on the facts. It's the interpretation of the facts that's debated. Well, we're going to ask ourselves a question. Which view gives a better explanation of the facts of the Big Bang? Which view provides a better explanation for these scientific facts? Theism, polytheism, pantheism, or atheism? Well, let's see. Polytheism is ruled out. The Enuma Elish, all of these different polytheistic deities were not strong enough to bring the universe into being out of nothing. Pantheism holds to an impersonal God who is ultimate and infinite, but not a causative agency, as Paul Davies describes it. He can't, or it can't, cause anything to happen. God is the same as the universe in pantheism. So that narrows us down to two major worldviews: theism, belief in God, or atheism. Well, I'd like to argue that the atheistic explanation is less powerful than the theistic explanation. Or to put that another way, theism has more explanatory power than atheism or naturalism. The atheistic explanation, in fact, is absurd. How does an atheist looking at these facts interpret them? Well, atheistic philosopher Quentin Smith, he's from Western Michigan University. He writes this in his book, Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology. The most reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. Wait a minute. This guy's a professor at a major university? How did the Big Bang happen? Can you explain that? Well, it was from nothing, by nothing, for nothing. J.L. Mackey, atheistic philosopher, in his 1982 book, The Miracle of Theism, he writes this: there is no good reason why a sheer origination of things, not determined by anything, should be unacceptable. Whereas the existence of a God with the power to create something out of nothing is acceptable. Do you agree with that? I think it's way easier to believe something came from something rather than to say something came from nothing. You know, years ago, atheists used to look at Christians and say, you believe that God brought everything into being out of nothing? That's absurd. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. Think about it like this. We've got a picture here of a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Okay. Let's think about this for a second. Which is more reasonable to believe? That someone pulled something from something. Okay. A magician, a causative agency, pulled something from something. Or that no one pulled something from nothing. How would that work? Do you find that easier to believe or not? R.C. Sproul, a Christian theologian, comments on this. He says, the modern view is far more miraculous than the biblical view. It suggests that nothing created something. More than that, it holds that nothing created everything. Quite a feat indeed. I have to agree with him. Let's look at our second point here. The origin of the universe confirms theism. The biblical authors knew this for centuries, that the universe had a beginning. For example, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Hebrews 11:3, that everything that's been made has been made from things which are not seen. Revelation 4:11, it's when John is praising God and he says that everything was created by your will. Your will brought things into being. And then we have two very interesting verses. Psalm 104:2 and Isaiah 40 verse 22. Two very interesting verses. These verses claim that the universe is actually stretched out by the hand of God. What Hugh Ross points out, it's a little bit speculative, but I like it. He points out that the term for stretched out in the Hebrew, in these two verses, is used of a tent being stretched out in empty space. In other words, what these passages imply is that the universe is in a continual expansion. Ross points out that no other view held this up until the 20th century. Now think about that. All of these ancient authors knew that the universe had a beginning. They knew that it was expanding. Imagine if we could hop into Marty McFly's time machine, go back in time, talk to a Jewish man, let's say 1,000 years before Christ, 3,000 years ago. Provided we could speak ancient Hebrew, we'd walk up to him and ask, how did you guys know this? How did you know that the universe began to exist? Everyone around you thinks that the universe is eternal, that matter and energy are eternal. You're an ancient Jew. You guys weren't good at science. You weren't even strong in philosophy. You don't have telescopes. How did you know that? How did you know that the universe began to exist? You know what that guy would have told you? He would have said, God told us. A pretty simple explanation, but pretty profound at the same time. You know, if the Creator who created the universe was there at that time, he would be able to communicate that to people through revelation. Robert Jastrow, an agnostic astronomer, this is from his little book, God and the Astronomers, a worthy read, doesn't believe in God. He was the founding director of NASA's Goddard Space Institute. This is what he writes here on page 106. This is an exceedingly strange development, unexpected by all but the theologians. They have always accepted the word of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So he's pointing out this is kind of strange that we came to believe this, but I guess the theologians had it right from the beginning. At the very end of his book, he says, for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. Kind of a funny way of describing it, especially from a guy who doesn't believe in God. He's just pointing out the obvious. Well, number three, we could point out that the Big Bang threatens naturalism. I would like to just read several quotes from physicists from the 20th century as this information and evidence was being compiled. They were starting to realize that the universe wasn't eternal like they had always believed. And as the evidence was coming in, this is what some of the atheistic astrophysicists and scientists were stating. This is Arthur Eddington. John Barrow places him second only to Einstein in the 20th century. This is one of the top astrophysicists of the 20th century. Arthur Eddington writes, I have no axe to grind in this discussion about the Big Bang, but the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible. It leaves me cold. He doesn't like it one bit. Here's what Philip Morrison, a professor at MIT, writes. I find it hard to accept the Big Bang theory. I would like to reject it. If I could, I would, but I can't because the evidence is so good. Jeffrey Burbidge, look at the chin on that guy there. Sorry, look at the chins on that guy there. He derisively spoke about the Big Bang as, quote, the first church of Christ of the Big Bang. In this article, if you read the original article, he says, anyone who's believing in the Big Bang, you might as well be in the first church of Christ of the Big Bang. Robert Jastrow, a lot of these quotes are from his book. He reads these quotes, or he lists the quotes off, and this is his commentary on those quotes. Check this out. There is a strange ring of feeling and emotion in these reactions. They come from the heart, whereas you would expect them to come from the brain. Aren't these reasonable, rational, logical scientists writing these things? Well, he says they're just having a complete revulsion to the facts that are piling in. Well, number four, the Big Bang demands an explanation. The Big Bang demands an explanation. Some people will just say, like Quentin Smith, like others, well, it's just a brute fact. It just happened, and it's a brute fact. We don't need to explain what caused it to happen. It just happened. Well, I think that's absurd. To say that we would look at all the other effects in our universe and try to give a cause for each one of those. The principle of sufficient reason would say that we should try and give causes for all the effects that we see in our universe. But to say that the biggest effect of them all, the biggest bang of them all, well, that's just a brute fact. We're not going to try and explain it. That'd be silly to do that. Well, think about it like this. Imagine you're sitting down for dinner with a friend, you're having a conversation. Just before you're about to bite into your food, you hear what sounds like a grenade go off outside the street. Boom! You know, and the entire building shakes and the glass shakes and you hear car alarms going off and people are screaming and you know, you jump out of your seat. What the heck was that? And just then your friend looks up at you and he says, you know, nothing caused that to happen. Just sit down and finish your dinner. Excuse me? Nothing caused that to happen? What, it just blew up for no reason? Would that explanation satisfy the mystery of that cause or that effect out in the street? Of course it wouldn't. Of course you would try and explain where that bang came from. Well, if little bangs need explanations, how much more do big bangs? The Big Bang, the biggest bang of them all, needs an explanation. Let's move on to certain objections to the evidence we gave, the cosmological argument. If we were to formalize this argument in a deductive argument, it would be premise one, everything that begins to exist must have a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist, therefore three, the universe had a cause. If everything that begins to exist has a cause, is that true? Yes, things don't just pop into being out of nothing. Secondly, the universe began to exist. Well, we can use all of modern science to confirm that second premise. Therefore, three, the universe had a cause. That'd be a formalized way of describing it. And pretty simple argument, too. That's the Kalam cosmological argument. Okay, let's look at some objections to this material. Objection one, which God is it? Many atheists come back at this point and retort, well, wait a minute. You think that the cause which created the universe, you think that that's the Christian God? Yeah. So from the Big Bang, you can figure out that this cause is Trinitarian, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And that this cause has a son named Jesus Christ who entered the world and died for sin. How do you know, as Sam Harris puts it, how do you know that this wasn't an evil God that began the Big Bang? How do you know it wasn't a billion gods that began the Big Bang? Well, here's the way that Michael Martin describes it. He writes in his book, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. There may have been trillions of personal agents involved in creation. How do you know it was just one God, capital G, that brought all of this into being? Well, I think a number of responses can be made to this objection. While we don't know all of the extra attributes of the cause, we can still know the essential attributes of the cause. What I mean by that is this. While we don't know everything about the cause of the universe, we can still know something about it. In other words, the cosmological argument isn't the one-size-fits-all argument. But what it does is it brings you to a cause that is at least all-powerful and volitional. At the very least, the cause has to be that much. So there are extra attributes. You know, God is all-loving. That's an attribute of God. God is all-knowing, omniscient. God is triune, Trinitarian. Can we get that from the cosmological argument? That would be really stretching it. I don't think we can. However, can we know that the cause is at least all-powerful, volitional, etc.? Yes, we can. Yes, we can. This was David Hume's critique of natural theology, that you're trying to prove too much. Well, we're not trying to prove too much. We're trying to prove very little, actually. Just that the cause is all-powerful, volitional. Well, the way I explain this usually is, imagine if you came out to your car and you found your window had been busted open and below your car is just a pool of glass. You look inside, the change has all been taken out of your ashtray in there and your stereo system's been ripped out. God, I hate when these guys do this to me. You call up the cops and you're sitting out in front of your car, just kind of sitting there waiting for the cops to show up. And your filthy, racist neighbor comes out. Okay? Your racist neighbor comes out. You don't even like this guy. You don't even want to talk to him. But he comes out and he sees you standing by your car. And he says, what happened here? He said, I don't know. Some thief came and busted into my car and stole my stereo. Was he black? Excuse me? Was he Mexican? Excuse me? Was he Asian? I don't know what nationality he was. I don't know what ethnicity he was. How do you know? How are you just assuming what nationality he was? I don't know if he was black. I don't know if he was Asian. I don't know if he was Hispanic. I don't know if he was wearing a dress. I don't know what his favorite color is. All I know is that somebody, some thief came and broke into my car and stole my stereo. I don't know the extra attributes of the thief. But I do know the essential attributes of the thief. I know that this wasn't a robot that broke into my car. Okay? I know it wasn't a dog that broke in here and stole my change and took my stereo. I know at the very least his essential attributes were that he was strong, he had motive, and he could lift a car stereo, throw a brick through a window. When we look at the Big Bang, the cause needs to be at least these six things. The cause needs to be at least these six things. A single, spaceless, timeless, immaterial, all-powerful, and volitional agent. Wait a minute. How do we know it wasn't trillions, trillions of thieves that came and stole your radio? Well, there's a philosophical principle called Occam's razor. How do we know it wasn't trillions of gods that brought the universe into being? Occam's razor. William of Ockham had a philosophical principle that was this. Entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity. What it means is, if one entity can be responsible for this effect that you're seeing, you shouldn't say that there was two. For example, you would never think 54 car thieves broke into my car and stole my stereo. Is it possible that they had some kind of Henry Ford assembly line where they brought the brick down and they tossed it in? It's possible. It's possible. You know, there's that story, Murder on the Orient Express. I don't know if you ever read that. I'm going to ruin the ending if you haven't read it by now. Sorry. At the ending, what you find out is that there were 12 murderers in a room, and they each had one knife, and they each stabbed the guy one time. So Monsieur Poirot, the detective, was looking for one murder. In fact, it was 12. It's possible. It's possible that there could be trillions of gods responsible, trillions of thieves who came and broke into your car. But Occam's razor, a trusted philosophical principle, states don't multiply entities beyond necessity. So that brings us to one. If one could do it, we shouldn't say that there is even two. Spaceless. Because this cause brought space into being, the cause needed to be spaceless. Timeless. Because the cause brought time into being, it, or he, she, it, needs to be timeless. Immaterial. Because all matter and energy came into being, the cause needs to be spiritual or immaterial. And all-powerful. I had a skeptic argue with me about this. Well, how do you know it's infinitely powerful? All we see is the universe. Maybe he's 90% infinitely powerful. I was like, well, whatever brought this universe into being is pretty close to infinitely powerful, all-powerful. And volitional. Volitional meaning having a will. Volitional. How do we know that the cause was volitional? Well, if the cause didn't have a will, then the universe would have never began to exist. What you need is a cause that can decide to move in and bring the universe into being. Eternal causes cannot give rise to temporal effects unless they're volitional. They come in and decide to do it. Okay, what about objection number two? Doesn't God need a cause? You said the universe needs a cause. Oh, that's great. But doesn't God need a cause too? Well, if you remember the formalized argument I gave you, the deductive argument, what did I say? Everything that begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe needs a cause. Anything that begins to exist needs a cause. However, God never began to exist. God never had a beginning. Well, this is the way Bertrand Russell describes it. This is in his famous book, Why I Am Not a Christian. He says, if everything must have a cause, then God must have a cause too. Fair is fair. See, atheists or skeptics say that this is special pleading to say that, you know, Christians say that God doesn't need a cause, but the universe does. That's special pleading. David Mills, in his book, Atheist Universe, The Thinking Person's Answer to Christian Fundamentalism. If you want a really good book on how much the God of the Bible sucks, pick up David Mills' book. It's awesome. Well, Mills describes it this way. If God created the universe, then who created God? They think it's special pleading. Everything that begins to exist needs a cause. Well, God never began to exist. Well, that's special pleading. You're applying rules to your opponent that you're not accepting for yourself. Well, how do we respond to this? Number one, this is a definitional error on the behalf of the arguer. It's a definitional error. This would be like asking, why doesn't a triangle have five sides? Let me think. Triangles have three sides, right? Why don't they have five sides? Well, just by definition, triangles don't have five sides. Why isn't a bachelor married? Why isn't a bachelor married? Bachelors, by definition, are unmarried. Well, why doesn't God need a cause? This would be like asking, who created the uncreated creator? By definition, that's the case. Number two, we can point out that something needs to have the attribute of self-existence, what theologians call aseity, meaning just existing from self in the Latin. Something needs to have the attribute of self-existence. If nothing had the attribute of self-existence, then nothing would exist. Do you realize that? If nothing had the attribute of self-existence, nothing would exist. Something must have that attribute. Now, either the universe itself has that attribute, or something beyond the universe does. But the point is, something has to have it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here talking. Bertrand Russell in a famous debate in 1948 on the BBC radio. It's debating. Copleston was a Christian philosopher. Copleston leaned in and said, "Dr. Russell, why do you think the universe exists?" Well, Russell came back to him and he said, "I should say that the universe is just there. And that's all. Just there." I swear if you're British, your IQ goes up 10 points. Well, that was a good explanation for atheists back then, wasn't it? Why does it exist? It's just there. That's all. But now when Christians say that God exists by his very nature, atheists don't seem to understand how we can apply that to God. Let me give you an illustration. I don't know if this is going to be helpful or hurtful, but I'm going to give it a shot. Okay. Something needs to be independent, not a contingent thing, a self-existent thing. Okay. Let me see if this will help. Let's say you need to get a loan, and provided you have really good credit, you go into your bank and you try and get a $100,000 cash loan. But you have really, really, really good credit. So you go into your bank Monday morning and you go up to your banker and general manager and you say, "I'd like to withdraw $100,000 from your bank, please." Well, he looks at your credit. "Okay, it's actually going to be a good loan." He says, I'll get you the money." He goes into the vault. "Shucks, we forgot to get money in our bank this morning." "Don't worry. What I'll do is I'll call down to bank number 2. They've got cash and they'll give it to us." So the manager calls down to bank number 2. "Hey, we need $100,000 for Joe Smith." Bank number 2 says, "Well, how's his credit?" "Good. Okay. Well, we'll give him the money." So bank number 2 goes to get the money out of its vault. And darn it, we forgot to put money in our bank. "Don't worry, bank number 1. We'll call bank number 3. So they call bank number 3. "Hey, we need $100,000 cash." "No problem." They go to their bank vault. "No money." "Well, don't worry. We'll call bank number 4. Bank number 4, same problem. "No money." All these banks just have no money for some reason. Must be the economy. But finally, they call bank number 5, bank number 6, bank number 7. Here's the question. If no bank is independently wealthy, will you ever get your cash? Can you just have a string of contingents, a string of dependents going back infinitely? No. There needs to be a bank that's independently wealthy that has the cash in its vault to give to bank number 6, and then bank number 6 can give that to bank number 5, to 4, 3, 2, 1, to you. In the same way, something needs to exist just by its very nature has self-existence. If it doesn't, then we just have a string of dependents going out into the past. Number 3, the universe had a beginning. We know that. Remember we said either the universe is self-existent, exists by its own nature, or something beyond the universe is self-existent and exists by its own nature. Well, wait a minute. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, something beyond the universe must have this in its very nature. So why doesn't God need a cause? Something needs to be causeless. So if the universe had a beginning, that needs a cause, but there must be something beyond the universe that has the attribute of aseity or self-existence. Objection number 3. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. Wait a minute. You said you talked a lot about the second law of thermodynamics. What about the first law, the conservation of mass energy? It says that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. But you just said that the entire universe sprung into being as a creative act of God, but doesn't that contradict the first law? This is the way David Mills describes it. He says, if mass energy cannot be created or destroyed, and if the universe is entirely composed of mass energy, then our universe of mass energy, in one form or another, always existed. You see his point. Isn't this contradicting the notion of the conservation of mass energy? Well, in retort to this view, we could point out a number of things. Number one, if Mills is right, he's arguing against the consensus of modern cosmology. How would you like to be sitting in his shoes? I'd be wetting my pants. You're arguing against the consensus of modern science if you're right. this would be a very awkward place to be in. So we have to ask ourselves a question, though. Okay. If this is a well-trusted physical law that matter can neither be created nor destroyed, and yet modern science teaches that energy and matter and everything came into being at the Big Bang, then this isn't just a problem for Christians, Christian apologists. This is a problem for modern physics. So the question is not, how does this harmonize with our view? It's, how do modern scientists harmonize the first law with the notion of the Big Bang? Well, let's explain it this way. Modern science teaches that physical law began at the Big Bang, but it doesn't apply before the Big Bang. That's not just wordplay. Modern science, what are physical laws? They're things which we observe as constant in nature. Could you observe constants in nature before nature existed? Of course not. Physical law began at the Big Bang. That's when physical law came into being. Most modern scientists you talk to do not say that physical law is immutable, only that that's what we observe 10 times out of 10, or 100 times out of 100, or 1,000 times out of 1,000. To put this another way, physical law is universally true within the universe, but not universally true for the universe. Think about it this way. Can you have grammar without words? You can't end sentences with a preposition. Can you have that grammatical rule without words? No. You can't have a grammatical rule without words to make sense of grammar. Can you have rules without a game? Of course not. You can't have rules unless you actually have a game to lay down those rules. Can you have speed limits without cars on a highway? No. Of course you can't. Can you have physical law without physics? Can you have physical natural laws without nature? Of course not. And that's how modern science resolves this dilemma. Well, let's pause for questions. That's the origin of the universe. Covered a lot. Let's pause a little bit and then we'll take our break. Covered a lot of stuff here. Yeah. Well, the premise is not that everything that exists has a cause. It's that everything that begins to exist has a cause. But what you'd have to do is give an example of something that has begun to exist without a cause in order to invalidate that first premise. Now, at that point, many atheists will come back with the subject of quantum physics. Out of the quantum vacuum will arise these subatomic particles. Okay? They'll just jump out of the quantum vacuum and then recede right back into the quantum vacuum. So many skeptics that you read will say, well, see, here's an example of something coming into being out of nothing and then receding right back into nothing. Well, we have to retort by saying the quantum vacuum is not an actual vacuum. It's not an absence of anything. The way that Paul Davies was saying, the universe began from what? From nothing. What do I mean by that? No thing. The absence of anything, to put that another way. The quantum vacuum is actually a roaring sea of energy out of which these particles will bring into existence. Well, we don't exactly know how these come in and out of existence, but we know that they're coming from something, not from nothing. So, and some physicists, like David Bohm, believe that there's actually a causal network where there's reasons why they pop into and out of existence. But even if he's wrong about that, at least they're coming from something, not from nothing. So, good question. Yeah. One line of evidence I didn't even get into is William Lane Craig's study of the subject of actual versus progressive infinites. It's not scientific. It's philosophical. It's deeply confusing. And I think it leaves people more confused than when they started. But Craig's point is that the idea of an actual infinite set of things cannot exist in reality. So you couldn't have an actual infinite number of marbles, an actual infinite number of subatomic particles. There's actually only 10 to the 80th subatomic particles in our universe. So the idea that there's an actual set of infinite things is impossible. That cannot exist. So if the universe is a series of events, then that would mean that the universe has an actual infinite number of events in its series, which is a logical impossibility. So Craig gives all these different explanations of, you know, Hilbert's hotel, where there's a hotel with an infinite number of rooms. And so somebody comes in to check into the hotel and they say, can I have a room for the night? And so the hotel manager says, well, let me check. No, all the rooms are filled in Hilbert's hotel. Infinite number of rooms. They're all filled. So the guy goes to leave and he says, wait a minute. All of the even numbered rooms are scheduled to check out in about 5 minutes. Can you wait? The guy says, sure. So all the even number rooms in the hotel leave. So an even set in an actual infinite set is how many? Infinite. How many are left? Infinite. Okay, so then there's a second explanation. Well, the hotel manager says, well, no, actually, just rooms 4 and to infinity, they're going to check out. And the Smith, Jones, and Robinson family, rooms 1, 2, and 3, they're going to stay. So you have an infinite number of people leaving the hotel. 4 to infinity is still infinity. How many do you have left? 3. So infinity minus infinity equals 3. Well, he gives all these different explanations to show that the idea of an infinite set is impossible. It can't exist in reality. So that would also be a charge against why the universe can be eternal.